The History of North America podcast is a sweeping historical saga of the United States, Canada, and Mexico, from their deep origins to our present epoch. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this exciting, fascinating, epic journey through time, focusing on the compelling, wonderful, and tragic stories of North America's inhabitants, heroes, villains, leaders, environment, and geography. This incredible historical adventure follows a path of exciting events led by interesting people who reach beyond their grasp to touch key moments in time. The History of North America podcast series is an educational and entertaining look at the thrilling chronicle of North America, an action-packed tale of a continent that is still unfolding. I invite you to come along for the ride.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 70, An Imperial Pilgrimage. When the Council of Nicaea wrapped up in the late summer of 325, the Emperor Constantine had already kicked off the celebration of his Viconalia. It must have been a happy time for many. The pagan persecutors had been defeated, and the controversy over Arius appeared to be over. Now the emperor was celebrating his 20th anniversary on the throne. Unfortunately for all involved, events over the next few years would undo much of this good feeling. In March of 326, the imperial court set out from Nicomedia for Rome to complete the Viconalia celebrations. With Constantine was his wife Fausta, who had by this point been given the great honorific title of Augusta. Also in tow were their five children, the Caesars Constantine II and Constantius II, their youngest boy Constans, and their two daughters, Constantina and Helena. Once they entered Italy, the court was joined by the emperor's oldest son, the Caesar Crispus, who had journeyed from his capital in Trier. Crispus was, by this point, a general and statesman with experience. After aiding his father in the war against Licinius, the young Caesar had ruled Gaul on behalf of the emperor for the past few years. By this time, Crispus and his wife also had at least one child of their own. And so, around April or May, Constantine was preparing to head south to the Eternal City with his wife and all his children alongside him. But then, something happened. When the imperial entourage finally entered Rome in July, Crispus was nowhere to be seen. To make matters worse, the citizens of the old capital seemed to have finally fallen out with Constantine. While they had welcomed him as their liberator back in 312, and then hosted his Decanalia in 315, it seems the emperor's more pronounced Christian faith angered the city's traditionally pagan citizenry. The emperor's unambiguous refusal to make the customary sacrifice to Jupiter Capitolinus upon his arrival seems to have been the inciting incident. But something else occurred which revulsed the people of Rome, pagan and Christian alike. The Empress Fausta was found dead in the baths of the imperial palace on the Palatine Hill. Only a few weeks after the emperor's arrival, the imperial visit was cut short. In early August, Constantine left Rome for Nicomedia, never to return again. So what happened? Did the emperor really have his own wife and son killed? The mysterious deaths of Crispus and Fausta have left an indelible stain on Constantine's record. Ordering the death of your own son and wife is a despicable act by any standard. Such actions must invariably weigh in on our assessment of Constantine as a historical figure. However, actually trying to figure out what really happened is extremely difficult. First, Constantine damned the memories of both Crispus and Fausta, and clearly went to great lengths to cover up whatever happened. Second is the problem with how these events were later treated by our ancient sources. Pagan authors from the 4th century onward naturally used the deaths to attack Constantine's character, and so likely exaggerate the details. In addition, they also make the false claim that the emperor only converted to Christianity in 326 out of his guilt and desire for forgiveness. In contrast, Christian authors take a far different route. Some, like Eusebius, refrain from even mentioning the events, while other authors attempt to deny them outright. Third, the deaths simply don't fit into what we know about Constantine's relationship with Crispus and Fausta up to this point. Fausta had given birth to 5 children and was honored with the title of Augusta. Crispus had been entrusted with real imperial authority as a Caesar for some time now. There is no indication that Constantine was in the midst of falling out with either his wife or son. Finally, though he had a temper, Constantine was certainly no Caligula or Nero. The idea that he just flew off the handle and in a fit of rage slew his 2 closest family members is hardly convincing. The first step to unraveling this morbid mystery is recognizing that Crispus and Fausta's deaths were separate and quite different events. Crispus was formally tried in person by his father for an actual crime. When Crispus was convicted, he was exiled to the remote town of Pola on the Histrian Peninsula, modern-day Pula in Croatia. There he was compelled to swallow poison. Fausta's death a couple months later in Rome was not a formal execution. You will sometimes read that she was literally boiled alive or cooked to death, but this appears to be an exaggeration from later pagan authors. Rather, her death was caused by suffocation in an overheated sauna, what we today know as hyperthermia. This is not a known method of Roman judicial execution, and none of our sources mention any sort of trial for Fausta as they do for Crispus. So her death was either a freak accident, an assassination, or suicide. Different modern historians have argued for all 3 scenarios. Since antiquity, the most popular explanation for the deaths is that Fausta attempted to seduce Crispus, and when the Caesar rejected her advances, the Empress accused him of attempting to rape her. Fausta's goal in this was to get her stepson removed so only her 3 sons would inherit the empire. This false assault accusation story has often been linked by modern historians to the harsh laws Constantine issued around this time against sexual immorality. I mentioned these laws a few episodes ago when discussing Constantine's legislation. The argument goes that Constantine, believing his wife's testimony, did not feel he could make any exception for such a serious offense, even for his own son. The story then goes on to relate that Fausta's calumny in the trial was later exposed in Rome by the emperor's mother, the Augusta Helena. Enraged, the emperor confronted his wife, who confessed her crime, after which Constantine had her locked up in the overheated baths until she died. There are several problems with this story. For one, it recalls familiar tropes of false rape accusations from ancient literature, such as in the Greek story of Hippolytus and Phaedra, and the biblical story of Joseph and the wife of Potiphar in the book of Genesis. Those of you familiar with Roman history will also recognize the wicked stepmother trope the Romans so loved. Some of Constantine's actions don't quite make sense either. It's hard to imagine the emperor being so committed to legal consistency that he felt obliged to execute his firstborn son. With regards to Fausta's death, if Constantine really intended to kill his wife, why did he do so in such a non-secretive way? Going back to Augustus and his daughter Julia, whenever emperors wished to remove a close family member, they were almost always exiled to a remote location first. Only later would they be killed, such as happened with Commodus and his sister Lucilla. This is also what happened to Crispus, who was first sent well away from the public eye to Pola before his death. By contrast, having Fausta die in the palace for all the imperial household staff to see or hear about makes little sense. A number of modern historians have proposed different solutions. Perhaps the most ingenious one I've read is by David Woods. Woods argues Crispus and Fausta were actually engaged in a protracted affair, which was brought to light when Fausta became pregnant with Crispus's child. Such a pregnancy would have created major dynastic problems, and so Fausta was compelled to undergo an abortion in a heated bath, a known abortion method in antiquity. Constantine did not intend to kill Crispus, but merely keep him exiled until events had died down. Crispus, however, believed his life was forfeit already, and so swallowed poison on his own accord. Later, Fausta's abortion was botched, and as a result, the empress died. Woods' hypothesis has the benefit of explaining the way in which Fausta died and why the memory of Crispus was never rehabilitated. You may remember that after the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, Constantine rehabilitated the memory of his deceased father-in-law, Maximian. Surely, if his son had been innocent, the emperor would have done the same for him. As creative as this reconstruction is, most historians haven't adopted it, as it requires Fausta to be away from Constantine during a good portion of the mid-320s to conduct the affair. But from what we can gather, Fausta was with her husband in the east during this time, while Crispus was all the way over in Gaul. So where does that leave us? One detail which the ancient sources agree upon, and which modern scholars generally regard as having a ring of truth, is the claim that Fausta somehow played a role in bringing about Crispus's downfall, and that her death was a consequence of this in some way. Both deaths are always mentioned together in the sources, and their closeness in time and place is highly suggestive. This leads to the hypothesis which I personally find to be the most convincing, that Fausta accused Crispus of high treason. There are a few pieces of potential evidence which suggest this. Licinius II, the son of Licinius and Constantine's nephew, he is usually thought to have been put to death with his father in 325. An alternative reconstruction, however, places his execution, and perhaps even the execution of his father, during the following year. In addition, the family of Crispus's wife remains unknown, but it has been reasonably conjectured that she was related to Licinius. Another official whose name also appears in the conversation is the Italian aristocrat Caonius Rufius Albinus. Albinus was from an extremely wealthy and distinguished senatorial family. Around this same time, he was also personally tried by the emperor for severe crimes and exiled. However, rather than meeting an ignoble end, Albinus was suddenly and swiftly restored to imperial favor and went on to have a successful public career. Putting these hints together, the plausible suggestion emerges that the emperor perceived a conspiracy was underway to overthrow him, which involved a number of officials and the house of Licinius, and Fausta convinced the emperor that Crispus was in on it. Perhaps the empress specifically alleged the conspirators' plan to replace Constantine with his son. If there is any truth to the attempted assault accusation story, it may be that Fausta framed this as another act of usurpation. That is, by bedding his father's wife, so to speak, Crispus was usurping the role of patriarch, paterfamilias, of the imperial family. In any case, it seems highly unlikely a sexual crime would make Constantine feel he had no choice but to execute his heir. But treason? Treason was a crime Constantine never spared anyone for, as the fates of Maximian and the two Licinii attest. Why would Fausta want to remove Crispus? At first glance, this would appear to be the wicked stepmother trope again. But here I think the trope may be warranted. To understand why, we need to look at Constantine's extended family tree. I've created a stemmata for you on the charts page of the blog site for reference. Fausta's predicament mirrored the situation of her older sister Theodora. Recall that Theodora, the elder daughter of Maximian, had married Constantine's father, Constantius Chlorus, during the creation of Diocletian's Tetrarchy. Theodora bore Constantius three sons. However, none of these sons inherited their father's imperial power. It was their older half-brother Constantine, the son of Constantius's first wife Helena, who became the next emperor. Constantine exercised headship and dominance in the family over his half-brothers, in part because he was so much older than them. Furthermore, Constantine had mostly kept his half-brothers at arm's length from imperial power. Like his father, Crispus was much older than his half-siblings. Even though two of Fausta's sons were Caesars, Crispus was already exercising imperial authority over Gaul. In contrast, Fausta's eldest boy was only around 10 years old. Not only that, but Constantine himself was by this stage in his mid-50s, the same age his father was when he died back in 306. If the emperor were to suddenly fall ill and die, Fausta's situation would be quite precarious, even dangerous. How inclined would a new Crispus Augustus be to respect the rights of his younger brothers, especially now that he had his own wife and child? For these reasons, then, Fausta's motivation for getting rid of Crispus seems quite plausible. To sum up, I think the most likely reconstruction of what happened is as follows. When Crispus joined the imperial entourage in northern Italy around April or May 326, Fausta accused him of being involved in a plot to overthrow the emperor. Forced to choose between believing his wife's testimony or his son's, Constantine chose the former. Crispus and other alleged conspirators were convicted and exiled. Over in Pola, Crispus was forced, or possibly chose, to swallow poison. After Constantine arrived in Rome, his mother Helena greeted him in mourning and confided her suspicions. The emperor subsequently confronted his wife, and the truth came out. In order to escape whatever vengeance Constantine would inevitably enact upon her for his dead son, Fausta took her own life in the heated baths of the Palatine Palace. The memories of both were damned. Constantine never officially spoke of them again, nor did he ever remarry. Constantine has been rightly condemned for his role in the deaths of Crispus and Fausta over the succeeding centuries. There's something quite personally revolting about causing the death of your own child or spouse. I do hope, however, that our exploration of these events has helped to provide a more nuanced and accurate picture of what might have really happened. I think too often, the story of Crispus and Fausta is simplified to just Constantine killed his son and wife for some reason in 326, without any attempt at explanation. Normally, I wouldn't go so far into an aspect of Roman dynastic history like this, but Constantine is such an important figure in our narrative, I felt it was needed. I hope in exploring this unpleasant subject, we have avoided the two extremes of the ancient sources, which sometimes crop up in modern accounts. We have not followed the pagan authors by using Crispus and Fausta as a bludgeon with which to beat Constantine, and indirectly the early church, over the head, and paint the emperor as a monster. Neither have we followed the Christian authors, who ignore, omit, downplay, or outright deny that these events really did happen. The dynastic tragedy rocked the imperial court to its core. When Constantine returned to the East, there was another prominent member of the imperial entourage who was also noticeably absent. His chief ecclesiastical advisor, Osius of Cordova, had returned to his native Spain. It's tempting to conclude that the bishop was so disgusted by the whole affair that he left the imperial court. While certainly possible, there are other, potentially more convincing reasons to explain Osius's departure. It's possible Osius simply chose to remain in the West once he returned. It's further possible Osius even used the tragedy to strengthen the emperor's faith through repentance. There may be an echo of this in the pagan tradition, which claimed Constantine converted to Christianity over his guilt. The local Christians in Rome certainly continued to receive imperial patronage, as new church buildings were still being constructed in the city at this time. The Vicinalia visit doubtless saw the imperial family display their generosity. Among the most devotedly Christian members of the imperial family resident in Rome was, as mentioned, the emperor's mother, Flavia Julia Helena Augusta. In order to make amends for the sins just committed, or distract the public with a grand PR move, depending on your perspective, the Augusta, who by now was in her 70s, resolved to go on an extravagant pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Constantine provided his mother with unlimited funds and resources to build churches, help the poor, and reaffirm to everyone that despite the recent tragedy, the house of Constantine was committed to the Christian faith. The result would be arguably the most famous pilgrimage in the history of Christianity. Since his conquest of the East in 324, it seems the emperor had had his eyes on the Holy Land. You may recall from our first three centuries series that a number of Christian holy sites had, for centuries, been obscured by local pagan worship. For instance, in Jerusalem, the visible part of the split rock of Calvary was adorned with a statue of the goddess Venus. Constantine was determined to remove all pagan pollutions and purify the sacred sites. It's possible that at the Council of Nicaea, Constantine had already discussed construction plans with Bishop Macarius of Jerusalem. Sometime after the council, the emperor's mother-in-law Eutropia, the widow of Maximian and mother of Fausta, undertook her own pilgrimage to Palestine. She visited the location of the Oak of Mamre, near the city of Hebron. Mamre had been a site of pagan worship for quite some time now, but in the Old Testament, it was where God and two angels had appeared to Abraham and Sarah, an event understood by Christian exegetes to be a theophany of the pre-incarnate Son. When Eutropia reported her discovery to Constantine, the emperor acted swiftly. He issued letters to local imperial officials to obliterate the pagan rites. The Augustus also issued letters to the bishops of Palestine and Phoenicia, gently rebuking them for not having reported such sacrilege to him sooner. He instructed them to work with the imperial officials to design and construct a new basilica at Mamre. Helena set out from Rome in the autumn of 326. On January 7, 327, she joined her son at her hometown of Drepanum in Bithynia. The emperor formally refounded the settlement as the new city of Helenopolis in her honor. The occasion was the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lucian of Antioch. Lucian's relics had recently been translated to Drepanum, and Helena was especially attached to the famous martyr. After this ceremony, the empress and her entourage left the emperor and continued their journey to Palestine. There, Helena acted as the official representative of her son, granting gifts and alms to cities, soldiers, and especially the poor. Criminals were granted imperial clemency and released from the prisons, mines, and other places of exile. Most notably, of course, the Empress gifted or endowed churches, even in smaller cities and towns. She founded the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem to honor the site of Christ's birth. She also founded the Church of the Ascension on the Mount of Olives to commemorate the location where the Lord ascended into heaven. Both structures would be further magnified by her son. When the Empress stayed in Jerusalem, she met with Bishop Macarius, who acted as her guide around the holy sites. Construction was already underway on a major basilica in the city. The basilica's different components were known in Greek as the Martyrion and the Anastasia. This basilica complex is better known to us as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Constantine seems to have originally planned to restore the site of Calvary. The idol of Venus was destroyed, and imperial workmen cleared the area around Golgotha. In the course of their excavation, though, they discovered two things which were the cause of great joy for both the local Christians and the emperor. One was the rock-cut tomb of Christ, which had been covered over since Hadrian's refounding of the city. The other discovery is the one for which the Empress Helena herself is usually given credit for, the true cross. Modern scholarship universally regards Helena's role in the discovery of the cross to be a later legend. Our earliest sources, including Eusebius, Constantine's letter to Macarius, and the writings of a bishop of Jerusalem from a couple decades later, all fail to mention Helena when discussing the finding of the cross. It is only in the late 4th century that the connection between the Augusta and the Holy Wood is made. Of course, it makes for a far more interesting story to credit the Empress, rather than an anonymous imperial workman, for such an amazing discovery. However, we can still give credit to Macarius, as he was overseeing the excavations, and it was to him that Constantine wrote after receiving word the cross had been found. The traditional date for the cross's discovery is September 14th, either in 326 or 327. Today, the discovery is commemorated in various traditions as the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross. The veneration of this most holy of relics became a staple of Christian life in Jerusalem, and soon pieces of the cross were being distributed to more distant regions, such as Mauritania. Constantine and Helena's Christianization of Palestine, and especially Jerusalem, marks the beginning of a new period in the history of the Holy Land. Because the land is sacred to all three Abrahamic religions, and because it connects Egypt and Arabia to the Fertile Crescent, Palestine has, for the majority of its history, been dominated by pagan, Jewish, and Muslim control. Aside from the brief stint of the Crusader kingdoms in the Middle Ages, the late Roman era is the only time in history in which the Christian Holy Land was a predominantly Christian place, which makes it a unique epoch in the land's history. By the late summer of 327, the Empress was wrapping up her pilgrimage in Palestine and preparing to head north. She continued doling out gifts and imperial largesse along the way. She passed through Antioch around early autumn, where she had some sort of exchange with the bishop Eustathius. After that, she returned west to Constantine at Nicomedia. When Constantine journeyed back to Gaul the following year, it seems likely his mother accompanied him to Trier. There, at the age of about 80, she died in Constantine's presence. A grand military escort took the Empress's body to Rome, where she was placed in an ornate porphyry sarcophagus that Constantine had once planned to use for himself. Helena was finally laid to rest in the imperial mausoleum attached to the Church of Saints Peter and Marcellinus. Helena is one of the most impressive women in the history of the early church. The Augusta's rags-to-riches life story certainly captured the imagination of many, while her pious deeds earned her recognition as a saint. She was accorded various epithets in subsequent Christian tradition, such as equal to the apostles and mother of the Christian Empire. Her pilgrimage to the Holy Land would become the stuff of legend, with the tale of her finding the true cross growing over time. In the Middle Ages, various new legends would add to her myth, connecting her with the island of Britain. On a more concrete level, Helena was really the first Christian Roman empress, and her model set a new precedent which later imperial women would seek to emulate. In later centuries, a pair of pious rulers would often be hailed as the new Constantine and Helena. Her posthumous title, Mother of the Christian Empire, certainly feels appropriate. If the deaths of Crispus and Fausta had marred the good feelings following the Council of Nicaea, Helena's pilgrimage was certainly a major positive counterbalance. Unfortunately, these new good feelings are about to be wrecked by a fresh round of internal strife, this time within the church. When Helena passed through Antioch on her journey back, she had some sort of encounter with the local bishop Eustathius, as I mentioned before. Not long after, a synod was convened within the city, and Eustathius was deposed and exiled. The Christians of Antioch were outraged at the loss of their beloved bishop, and rioting ensued. Things became so bad that imperial troops were called in to quell the unrest. The emperor himself wrote letters to the Antiochians in an attempt to de-escalate the situation and restore peace. So what in the world happened which brought about the downfall of Eustathius? Could it have anything to do with Eustathius being a fierce anti-Arian? Despite their defeat at Nicaea, Arius and his allies were about to make a comeback. Next episode, we'll see how this comeback begins and sets the stage for 2 decades of renewed ecclesiastical power.